Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop mechanic and ride with it all the way to the Linden stop. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Linny Shell. One of the reasons I wanted to make this series on actual play in the first place is I've always had a mismatched relationship to the medium. It is, in theory, so compelling to me, but in practice, I so often feel distant from it, and I wanted to dig into why that was. I think you can hear a lot of what I've learned about all that in my first episode in this series with Rowan Zioli, where we talk about the tensions between fiction and nonfiction in actual play. Our audience is here for the story the game creates, the story of the artists playing the game, or the magic that happens when those two things collide. I think you can probably hear what I think in there, but I also think so many actual plays give short shrift to that nonfiction layer specifically. And it was while kicking around all these ideas that Linny Shell and Twice Rolled Tales, the actual play studio they've co-founded, released Last Train to Brooklyn, a 90-minute actual play of Last Train to Bremen set on a New York City subway car. This thing is my favorite actual play. I don't know that it's the best or highest quality actual play out there, but for me, it so absolutely nails that nonfiction layer in a way that exemplifies what I find most compelling about this medium, and where I want to see it pushing artistically, deeper and more explicitly into the nonfiction layer, and the ways that that's in tension with the fiction. And quick plug, Linny and Twice Rolled Tales are already doing more of that pushing with a new 10 Candles actual play they released just last week that's set on a camping trip around a bonfire. Check them out. When I invited Linny on the show, the moment I most wanted to highlight from Last Train to Brooklyn is at the very end of the piece. But to properly set that up, I felt like we kind of needed to go through the whole damn actual play first. So that's what you're getting today. Me extracting essentially a full beat-by-beat director's commentary from Linny as we hurtle down the tracks towards this thing's inevitable conclusion. So come along with us, buy a ticket. Train's leaving the station. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. And here is Linny Shell with a 4 a.m. meal at a diner on the last train to Brooklyn. Linny Shell, welcome to Dice Exploder. Thank you so much for being here today.
I am so enthused. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. Not to spoil things here, but I think this is my favorite actual play of all time. And I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
I mean, that's exactly what I set out to create. So I'm so excited to hear that.
Sam Dunnewald's favorite actual play of all time. That was the goal. Okay, I want to start with, like, what is your background with tabletop games and with actual play, like, coming into the creation of this thing?
Sure. So I actually started doing actual play about the same time I started playing tabletop games, which I think is a common story that some people have for sure. But my background was primarily in theater, so doing a lot of props and kind of background work. And I think I played like two episodes of a game. You can even hear it there, like two sessions of a game back in college. But like for some reason, I just never was with people who were doing it. Like, I really don't know how it happened, because when I started playing it, people, you know, sat down and were like, Linny, why have you not been doing this your whole life? And I'm like, I don't know. Tell me. So I was doing mostly props, and I got really into kind of pop-up and experiential stuff. So doing, you know, if you're familiar broadly with like Meow Wolf, kind of the Sleep No More stuff, you know, like every year I'd put on a big production where we'd get a bunch of artists and sound people and sculpturists and you know, really kind of everyone I could draw artistically from a different area, throw them all together, and we do like something in a big house or a convention center, that kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, the pandemic hit, and so doing stuff in person became less possible. And then right about the end of the pandemic, I moved to New York City with my roommate, who's also one of the co-owners of Twice Rolled Tales, kind of partner in crime here. And from there, I think, you know, it was honestly some of the Dimension 20 stuff that came up. So I had really had this misconception that tabletop was really kind of all just D&D, and like, you know, my friends had played it for years, and they had just been playing really combat heavy, really getting into the nitty gritty of the fighting and the math of it. And I just, like, that was not my journey with it. And so I was like, oh, well, this is not for me. And then, you know, you see stuff on Dimension 20, and I know over the pandemic I was like hearing more about it. And I was like, oh, I could run some of that. So I ran like one like 10 episode adventure, like murder mystery, and it was all online. And so I did this really fun thing of created like four separate sets of props that were all the clues. I packaged them into envelopes. And they were all numbered. And so as we were playing, like, people could discover clues and open up envelopes. And then the really fun thing about that was there was informational asymmetry. Yeah. So if one player opens up an envelope, the other players do not necessarily have access to those clues.
Yeah.
And so I think that was like really the first time that I was like, oh, I can play these games. And then there's just something about, oh, I can also play with the structure of how we are playing it. And
yeah.
that could be really fun. And then I ran one more one shot over like Thanksgiving in person. And it was the most fun I'd ever had in my entire life. And then, you know, and honestly, right after that, I got bullied by my friends into starting an actual play company.
Well, it does seem like you were really well positioned for it there. Like,
yes.
I think that theater kid kind of background, and not just like theater kid enthusiasm, but like actual practical skills. Like, one of the things that we'll get into here is how much the costumes, the sets, the production design of this thing feel really well taken care of.
No, for sure. Like, I like to say that it really just felt like this thing was waiting for me, and I spent a decade developing all the skills to be able
yeah.
to do the projects I want in it. And
yeah.
so when I stepped into it, I was like, oh, there's still so many things I need to learn, but like the base level skills I've already really practiced a lot of.
Okay, cool. So that's your kind of background. You're coming out of all that. Like, talk to me about the idea for Last Train to Brooklyn specifically. Maybe let's start with, where did you first encounter Last Train to Bremen?
I have no idea.
Sure.
I think what it was it was probably one of the press announcements in Rascal. And I pulled it up and, you know, you just read something and you're like, okay, this is something incredible. And so it just stuck in the back of my head. And like, I grew up in the South, and like, I don't think you can grow up in the South without having a certain feeling about the devil.
Sure.
And so just the devil, and then combined with the fact that like, I had moved to New York City, and I was doing this, like, being creative with people in New York City and working with all of these different people and different teams and hearing about how it went bad and good and great and awful. And so the two of those things just kind of sat in my head for maybe, like, 6 months.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, this, you know, it's that combination of, like, this will tell a good story, and this will also be something that, like, not just a great story, but, like, I feel like I have something I want to say with it, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So what was that thing that you wanted to say? What were your goals for this? It was having a particular thing to say, one of those goals. And if so, what was that thing?
Yes, definitely. Okay. So there are definitely several things. So I think the first thing was, I have all this experience and have done all these things in physical theater, but also in this like improvisational pop-up set type thing where there's actors and the audience are all kind of together. And the full extent of the piece is only finished once it has been experienced by the audience. That
sure.
there is a sense of like, it is incomplete until someone steps into the room to see it. And with a lot of the AP that we were doing, I was kind of missing that feeling. Like that we were just kind of sitting in a room by ourselves.
Hmm.
And I was like, what can we do to bring the outside world into this so that we don't feel like we're just sitting in a room? And so I wanted to, I just really love putting things in places where they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, we have this incredible city. I want to put stuff in it. I want to be in different places. I think part of it was just an instinct to be in a different space for the first time. And I think the other things, first off, were camera work. So I wanted to really test the limits of what the team could do with the camera and what I had kind of seen coming out in the past couple of years, at least within the circle of things I was seeing. To a large extent, it felt like all the camera work I was seeing was primarily doing kind of the same thing, right? It was a camera in place, or, you know, multi-cams switching
yeah.
between shots, and that was it. And I was like, okay, well, we have like 100 years of film language to draw
yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm not reinventing any wheels here in terms of like film, the actual thing the camera is doing, right?
Yeah.
And it felt like a lot of, you know, people I talked to were just like, it was really hard, you know, it's really hard to do stuff on the street when you were also improvising a show around it.
And with only one camera too, like
that was intentional.
Yeah. Well, there's the clear, like, creative payoff for only doing one camera, but that like makes it logistically so much harder too. Like, you can't be cutting, right? Like you just have
the amount of times where the camera team would be like, so we could add, and I was like, no, one camera. Well, so that was the other part of the intent. One was, okay, so I know I have the skills to do something logistically challenging with the camera, right? I know I have the skills and the team and the people and the time. and the resources to go do something really cool. And the other thing is like, okay, well, if I do something really cool and no one else who does not all have all of those time and resource and logistics can't even do something close to that, it doesn't make it not worth doing, but I think I'm more interested in stuff that adds to the collaborative artistic toolbox, as it were.
Sure.
So it's like, okay, well, if I go out and film something with three different cameras and a GoPro and a drone and all of that, I mean, I'm going to go film stuff like that because we have a drone and I'm going to use it. But like, okay, what can we do that is one camera that someone, you know, who has a really strong artistic vision and an iPhone and a couple of okay mics could also replicate, right? They could, they could take that idea and build on it. And, you know, you probably aren't going to be able to do anything in the subway if you don't have good mics, but you could do something somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
So it was really important to me that there was replicability with this as well.
Yeah,
and then the other element was kind of this push toward parasociality and then also this friends at a table kind of thing that we reference a lot in actual play as a style of actual play.
Yeah, and that is in some ways synonymous with actual play when it, I think, should not be.
Sure. Yes, no, that's, and that was exactly, I think, really the core of this was a frustration that it felt like, A, people were pushing the fact that you had to develop this parasocial relationship with your audience, and B, that the only way to do that was to cultivate this sort of friends at a table mentality, right?
Mm-hmm,
where you're, and I really don't think that that is a bad way of producing actual play, because I think a lot of actual play, the joy in it for me is that you get to see creator and creation happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And friends at the table is a way of doing that. I just wish that we had more lexicon when we were making stuff that was readily apparent right now in our industry of friends at the table is one lens to tell that story with.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell a similar story, like really focusing in on creative and creation, but I wasn't necessarily interested in people feeling like they were there at the table with us. And I wanted people to be able to experience the joy of the thing we were creating and like to understand why we cared about it so much, without necessarily feeling like they had to know everything about us as people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is also a lot of actual plays do not necessarily put a lot of work up in the front end to introduce what they are doing to an audience. And I think part of that is preference of AP audiences. You know, I see a lot of like, why is there all this intro stuff, people talking, just get to the story. It's like, that is one style.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were trying to get people to watch your actual play or listen to it who are not familiar with that style, it's sort of like opening up a play without even telling people what they're seeing. Right? They're just like, behold my thing and like it. And I just don't know if that's accessible to a lot of people all of the time. And I think parasociality becomes a shortcut for that. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to have to put the work in differently, but we have to put the work in. And so that's really where the idea of this like documentary style came from. I think this has definitely been floating around, you know, with other people as well. But for me, like seeing a lot of street documentary that has been done in New York City was really a strong reference point for this. And I'm forgetting the name, but there's these incredible videos of RuPaul throughout like the time when he was go-go dancing. And it's shot in the style that became a big reference point for Bremen, because it is both really focused on the subject and then also really focused on the subject interacting with New York City and becoming part of that landscape. So there's points where you'll still be hearing Rue, but the camera will be pointed at someone else, you know, while she's talking. And so that style of introducing the subject by showing what they care about rather than telling you why you should care about them was really the thing I was trying to do here.
That's really, there's like six different things I had to write out that I wanted to come back to and everything you just said. And we didn't even get to my original question of like, what were your goals for the actual like creative part of this, like the audience. But like, I want to start with like, how do you open a show excitingly? Like people talk about how you need to just like get into the story and not bog down your audience with like introducing the players and the characters and the world and everything else. But I feel like you found a way to make that part interesting and compelling. And I don't know, I'm just curious if you have thoughts more generally on how do you take that phase of any actual play and make it compelling?
Yeah, so I would say I am still figuring it out, because I think there's this balance between how much do you want to talk about what you're doing and how much do you want to just get into it? And so the impulse to just get into the story makes sense.
And it is valid. I've listened to actual plays absolutely. Where they do that, and it's super effective, right?
There's a reason why it's become, I think, a common piece of advice, because it's really effective, and for sure is more effective than having an ineffectual intro. If you're gonna, if you're not gonna be able to be engaging in the intro, it makes total sense.
If the intro is bad, you don't want to start with the bad stuff, right?
Exactly.
But there is this other question. The point here is what if intro wasn't bad? Right?
And
maybe we're trying
bad.
To figure that out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it. I have been focused on, again, I think the why of it, not the what. And so for me, it's really just about reflecting the themes of the game into the interactions that we're having. And really emphasizing why those themes are important to what we're doing and why we care about them.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of explaining the rules to people, there are absolutely actual plays that focus on the rules, and that is a core part of what they're doing, and it's important.
Yeah.
For most of the actual plays that we have done, you know, and certainly Last Train to Brooklyn, and to some extent the Ten Candles one we did, are pretty unconcerned about that.
Yeah.
The answer is I just didn't, to some extent, explain things, and that.
But you explained the right things, right? Because the core of Last Train to Brooklyn and Last Train to Bremen, as far as I'm concerned, is four bandmates mess, right? It's their relationships and just being messy at each other, and in some ways, the mechanics of the game, the rules of the game around that. That layer, that mechanical layer fading into the background fits what the game is striving for, right? Whereas if you were making a very pedagogical actual play of Last Train to Bremen that's really focused on explaining how Liar's Dice works, right? And I guess there's something going on with the band. It would feel really out of place to me. It would not feel in sync with what the game is trying to do. And that AP might still be valuable because maybe people need a video to learn how to play the game so they can go play with their friends. But it's a really, really different thing and much less, I think, sort of artistically aligned.
I think part of it is about, I think there's this impulse to not trust your audience. Mm. And I'd rather have three people watch the whole thing through than five people feel like they kind of understood it, but be sort of bored the whole time.
Sure.
It's okay to make art that's not for everyone.
Yeah.
You can even see it when you go on the actual video. I mean, there are people who are like, I don't like the shaky cam. This makes me nauseous. You should put this all on sticks. And it's like, okay, there are so many actual plays on sticks.
Yeah.
Go watch one of those. This just is not for you. And so, I think it's like making this actual play was for people who didn't necessarily care that things weren't revealed immediately. And the physical, the fact that we are going on a journey is important, right? It is visually and literally saying, hold on, we're going somewhere. Just ride it out with us. You're going to figure out what's happening. We're not going to leave you hanging. You are coming with the band.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to return to my original question here of I feel like you've set out a lot of production goals here. You've talked about a bunch of different audiences. You are talking about wanting to make something that could be a template for other actual play creators. You're making a game for each other too, clearly. You're making something that you're going to enjoy, but you're also making something for an audience at home. And I want to return to that question of what were your creative goals here?
Sure.
Not just sort of your technical goals, thematically in your mind, what is this actual play about? Ruin the joke for me.
Okay, great. I want to return just a little bit back to what you're saying of the audience being they're clearly being a production facing audience for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that was intentional. I think we talk a lot about the actual audience for actual play. And I think there's a certain amount of the people who watch actual plays are also the people who make and produce them, and how much are we a hobby or not.
Great point.
So I'm not if it feels like it was made for my peers in some ways, because it was.
Yeah.
I think we have to be honest about how many people actually watch it who are audience members versus people who are the makers of the thing, and how much this is in conversation with the community who makes things versus the community who just watches it. So I think part of it, the audience was definitely for that. And then
I think that's a fabulous point. I think also as someone who I only occasionally create actual play, but I'm a part of that audience. When I'm watching something like this, there's two copies of me watching it at once, right? Like, there's the version that you are speaking to there, but there's also the version who, even if I'm a creator, is just here to experience the thing, right? So, like, speak to that person.
Sure, sure. So there's this feeling that you get when you go to a show, and maybe this happens in different cities, but I think, and it is cliche, but it doesn't mean it's not true, that it really happens in New York City in a special way. When you go to something with your friends or people who you know who are creative, and you see something interesting, and it's really cool, and you talk about it a bit, and then you go home, and it's a long subway ride because you're all riding somewhere, and then someone starts talking about something fun or interesting or creative or an idea that they've been bouncing around, and you spend 45 minutes talking about this thing in the subway, and you never would have sat down and hashed it out if you didn't have somewhere to go together. Mm-hmm. And that feeling is so wonderful. And I just want people to also feel that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that that was the reason that we wanted to put it in the subway, not just the reason why a Last Train to Bremen AP should be in the subway.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer.
And I would say the other half of that is, like, I think for me, the other core of the creative story here is that, you know, I did only move to New York City like 4 years ago, give or take. So I feel like I am very much in that first, everyone is here and everyone is making things.
Yeah.
And nothing has gone wrong yet, really.
Mm, yeah.
Things have gone like complicated or like logistically challenging, but nothing has really gone wrong.
Yeah.
And, well, you know how these stories go.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
And so part of me just wants to really celebrate the creative impulse and that with these group of wonderful people I'm with now. And then there's a part of me in the back of my mind thinking, well, how is this going to end?
Yeah.
And I do not think it's going to end as badly as, you know, the four players.
As literally being dragged to hell. Yeah.
No, but there's a certain amount of, like, I mean, it's an inevitability. People move out. People, change careers. They do stuff. So there's a sense of
time marches on. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Wanting to celebrate the here and now and really live in that wonderful moment.
Yeah, totally. I want to ask you some technical questions.
Yes.
So I watched this and I had a lot of thoughts and like strong emotional reactions to the quality level that it presents as, right? Because I don't mean this in an insulting way. I would describe this as like very lo-fi and like presenting as very unpolished in its production, right? Like it really reminded me of being in my parents' basement in 2004 with like a camcorder and like running around like making films, right? And I mean, you were mentioning this, like some people can't watch that shit because it makes them motion sick, right? Like in some ways it looks bad, right?
It does.
But I also, so Jesse David Fox works for Vulture. He wrote a book about stand-up comedy. He's like a major stand-up comedy critic. And he had this podcast called The Specials that was just like, we're going to break down one comedy hour per episode and like review it like it's a movie kind of thing. And something that he would often say on that was like, if this were any better, it'd be worse. And
yes.
I feel so strongly about that regarding Last Train to Brooklyn of like, if you did put this on sticks, if you made it look nicer, if you like did all that, it would completely lose the like really important texture of it feeling lo-fi and unpolished that I think like is really relevant to it thematically. And you're nodding so much and like humming along with this. So it feels like that was all very intentional on your part, but I just want to hear you reflect on that.
Yes. So, I mean, I think you've kind of have just covered it. But yeah, it was absolutely an intentional choice. Even the lens we used was a lens that had been literally taken out of a disposable camera.
Oh my God.
Stuck onto a lens cap and just screwed in. I mean, you can buy these online. We didn't make that ourselves. But yeah. So there is a lens on this camera, but it is not a real lens in essence.
And it fucking looks like it.
It's
like,
great. Those lens flares.
It's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it was practical because that lens cap was very light and then made that camera not look like a camera.
Yeah,
so in terms of taking it places, no one got wigged. And it was really light. And especially since our incredible camera folks were going to be holding that thing for upwards of 45 minutes to an hour with you know, obviously like breaks if they needed it, but essentially no breaks. That had to be as light as possible. So it was really a happy coincidence that the style we wanted also had some really practical applications that kind of sealed any cons that might have existed. And the other thing is about it is that it has infinite zoom. So if you watch it, you'll notice there are no zoom moments in Last Train to Bremen. The only way you can get closer to something is by physically moving the camera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that really influenced the kind of the point of view that I wanted to have here. And we didn't even get into this, but like the point of view of the camera, which put a pin in because I do want to talk about that. Yeah, and the fidelity of it, in part it was in reference to all of these home videos that you see kind of early, you know, anywhere from like the 80s to the early 2000s of New York City. Yeah. Like if you watch anything from Casey Neistat, you'll also be familiar with that kind of vibe. And so I wanted to reference that because I wanted this to feel a little timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason we shot it on the trains that we did. So those trains have been in circulation since like the 70s.
Oh, wow.
And actually, they're being taken out of circulation this year.
Oh, my God.
So we almost missed our window to film with those trains.
Yeah.
I must have gone to half of the trains in New York City just to like figure out which ones made sense, because some of those trains are the right color and vintage, shall we say.
Yeah.
Don't have the right seat configurations. And again, back to that idea of intent of like telling this universal creative story and then also telling our own story. It was important that it be a subway car we actually ride, but then attempt to reference other decades and put a sense of nostalgia into it.
Yeah. This is such an interesting thing about nostalgia, that by capturing, like, some of it feels like it's straight out of the 70s. Some of it feels like it's straight out of 1999. Some of it feels very contemporary. And all of those things, like, together make it feel timeless because it is, like, simultaneously in all those times. Yeah.
I mean, it's a thing you see in theater a lot of, like, you want to set something to be timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is you reference a couple of, you know, very specific anachronistic devices.
Yeah. Yeah.
That could still plausibly exist now, but probably existed in the past. And then you add more modern layers on top of it. And together people can't quite hold on to that in their head in the same way of where, when and where you are. But yeah, so I do think about the impulse to reach back into nostalgia and to be timeless. And that effect looks so cool, but I think it's important to be kind of careful with it. Like, it's not something we're using in the next AP that we filmed, because I really want to be making stuff now, you know? And if you're always reaching back to the language of the past, then I think you can forget that you're making stuff for now.
What were you growing up with? You know, you weren't born in the 70s, were you growing up with like the tail end of those digital home videos, or were you growing up like with something else? Like, what era is nostalgic to you that like you would be or not be pulling from on this?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really allowed to watch television growing up, and not in more like a granola way. My parents were like, here are your books, and we'll occasionally watch movies. So I think if anything, it would be for like early VCR recordings, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think we had like a VCR recorder. But I was very young, so I would never have like physically interacted with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, like early 2000s, you know, like a flip phone would make me feel nostalgic. Like the internet was always an extant presence in my life, but definitely one that I had seen develop.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think I really referenced anything that I would personally find nostalgic, like for Bremen. This was very much looking at like what people who lived in New York City before me would have found nostalgic, and like reaching back into that, I think.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I don't think people, including you, can help themselves in terms of like what they're pulling out in that regard. Like your point of reference there is still really interesting context.
For sure.
Okay. So I want to move on to the next big topic I wanted to get into before we kind of go like beat by beat through the thing, which is, I'm going to groan as I say it, but like, New York City is a character in this thing, right? Like, that's...
It is. It's fine. New York City, that's just the thing, baby, right? The Big Apple.
Most people... Oh, my God. Most people...
Look, like, you gotta own it.
You gotta own it. But also, like, most people who try to do this, like, fuck it up big time. And like, you didn't. Like, you really succeed at it, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear... You've already done, like, a significant amount, even, of, like, talking about this and the specificity of New York. to all of this, but I'm curious to hear you like take that topic head on. What is important about New York to you in this? And like, what part of New York did you want to capture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing people get wrong about New York is they think there is a New York.
Yeah.
And the reality is there are a million different smaller New Yorks.
Yeah.
And the reason I think it works here is because, going back to kind of the whole thesis of the thing, we're not going to the big places in New York. We're going to the ones we care about.
Yeah.
And showing you our New York and how that feeds into what we're doing and how we exist here. And then by extent, the stories that we're making.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even the bar we come out of, like, it's never mentioned, but like, that's my favorite bar in the city. Like, it's an incredible piano bar. It's, depending on how you define it, the oldest gay bar in New York City. Mm. You go and you sing show tunes and it's all acoustic. It's great. And I think it is important that we exited it from there. And I think people can feel that it was important. I don't think we have to explain it necessarily. But yeah, so it's just that every place we were going meant something, or that we could have gone there. And I think it's we're not trying to impress anybody with it, I think, is the other thing.
Yeah.
It's just where we live. Like, genuinely, it's awesome. But we genuinely live here, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Your next favorite game is on My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Ho, 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 and welcome to My First Dungeon.
From Sad Space Cowboys.
Kamari takes out a lighter from their pocket and goes, this bar's next.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
To death metal Viking cats.
Hello Kitty, you see Melody Tuffington flying through the air, jacked as shit, massive legs, to horny snowmen?
The sad part is that Joshua never gave Frosty a penis.
No.
And everything in between.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We've got something for everyone.
You're a special Gertrude girl in a special Gertrude role. Happy birthday, happy birthday. I'm not a skeleton.
Learn the game, then hear it in action.
That's Snake Eyes minus two. That's a zero.
Snake Eyes, that means that we have our very first plot twist. Anytime somebody rolls doubles, we get a plot twist.
So grab some headphones.
And get lost in a story with us.
I'll be honest, I don't know all the rules of it. We'll kind of figure that out as we go. But do you want to just play? I've got some great stories to tell you.
And remember,
if you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Oh, fuck.
All right. I want to kind of like walk through beat by beat what this thing looks like. So we start off and the camera starts like outside with this establishing shot of the bar. And the four of you, the main cast, come out of the bar and we get y'all just like bantering as regular friends or people. Mm-hmm. And then we go into, you like go and get pizza, you sit down and you start doing the like initial like character questions for each other and establishing those relationships. And I found this really interesting moment where at the start of the proper moment of play of like, let's do the character relationships, someone is like, let's like stay out of character here. Like, we're not fully in character yet. And then immediately people start role-playing in character.
Yes.
And like that's what I see as this like first act of playing with that line of like, are we in character or are we out of character? Talk to me about that section. What's important to you about that section?
Yeah, I mean, this was my attempt. And what I thought was really important here was to show, not tell.
Yeah.
So if the thing I'm trying to do is make you care about the characters, the story we're telling, showing us beginning to care about them is the easiest way of doing that. And I think the most impactful.
So showing us beginning to care about them, you mean you caring about the characters?
Yes. So showing the players beginning to care about these characters.
Yeah.
To work them out, to feel them, to put them on, to take them off, to put them on differently, to take them off again. That is part of the process. And it's such a, it's play, right? It's half the half of the game is that play. And it so often gets cut out as like filler and not important. And you're like, that's the magic of creation they're doing right here, right? You you see them try something, it not work, try something and it really work, double downing on that, you know.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, so, you know, I made these Dice Explorer after images earlier this year, and like going into those, my goal, thank you. I'm very proud of them. The next one is going to be fucking fantastic too.
Hell yeah.
I'm going into those, like I had this feeling of like why is it so hard to tell people about what happened at your RPG table? And how can I like actually succeed at doing that? And to me, the thing that I determined was the hard part is that any RPG story is happening on several layers at once, right? It's happening on the like real life relationships between the players and the fictional relationships between the characters and all these like people's relationship to the game. Like you have to understand how the game works, and people are like doing that thing you were just describing of coming in and out of character, like they're doing that play, and you have to have so much context on so many different layers to be able to like figure out why a particular moment was emotional. And often like a moment is emotional because it's operating on several of those layers at the same time, right? Like in the second after image, there are moments where it's like, I am having a really strong feeling because I am thinking about my grandpa who's dying, and also, like, in play, someone is role-playing as my grandpa and doesn't know that context about me, and, like, all of that is happening all at once. And I think you are doing a great job here of introducing all of those layers, the ones that are going to be relevant for the audience at home anyway, all at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like, I just want people to, I want to show people why we care so much and have them care as well. And it's just so much fun. Like, gosh, we're having so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's it too. And like, I think you make this really smart choice in there too of like, okay, we go from the bar to the pizza and we're just bantering as friends along the way. And then we do the round of questions. And then it's like, all right, so we want to get gelato next. And then we like show some more, like we're just walking along the street and like singing a song together and like very much back in character mode and not, or excuse me, it's blending together in my speech, right? Like we're back to like person, real life, out of character mode and friendship mode. And then like diving back into the relationship stuff.
And I think the really fun thing is to me that they are separated in the AP visually sometimes, but they are not distinct.
Yeah.
Like friendship mode is happening the whole time.
Yeah.
Like
every
time that I say something really nasty to Rowan, they're also having as much fun as I am.
Yeah.
Slinging that back and forth with me and showing that we're having. Yeah.
And we feel good about it because you did the work to establish friendship mode up top. Okay, so then there's a snake. I love you with the snake. It's not Linny, but like two of you have a snake. It's incredible.
There's a whole bit we had to cut out where we bargained the snake guy down from $20 because he's like two people is $20. Two people is $20. That's great. Yeah.
Incredible. But like that's the kind of that feels like straight out of like your New York City too, and it's like that combined with like I love. Anytime in anything that I'm watching or making, I love it when you get a scene that serves multiple functions at the same time. And like here, the one of those functions being friendship and the other being New York, baby, like transition. It's like all three of those at once like that. It's really effective.
Yeah. And that was 100% like the direction I gave the rest of the players was like follow your id a little bit. Like if there's a thing that you would run across the street to go check out for 5 minutes. And we have time. Let's go do that. Let's see if we can capture. Like, that is, I don't want to pull back from that, you know?
Well, that's actually a great lead into a question I forgot to ask earlier, which is like, how much did this feel to you like performing for the camera versus capturing what you would have been doing on a Friday night anyway?
Ooh. Well, here's the thing. On a Friday night anyway, I would have been on camera.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit like, maybe a little glib, but like that, I think, is kind of the answer.
Interesting. Well, so in what capacity would you be on camera?
Like doing actual plays or, you know, talking to folks or something like that. Sure. But like, I think there are two parts to this answer. But the first part is because I came to this from the realm of theater and not from the realm of a player who then wants to put this online.
Yeah.
My experience with actual play and with a lot of games is much more like this is a script rather than mm-hmm. this is a game that I'm going to play for myself and then put online.
Yeah.
So there is a little bit of, I have been learning how to play games for myself recently.
Interesting.
More than the other way around.
Yeah.
So it feels more natural for me to be playing a game on camera than it does the other way around, I think.
Yeah.
In first part. And second, I think the only thing that I think felt more filmed than not would be we would often go back and reshoot entrances and exits. So not like content necessarily, but us getting up or moving.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we do it once and it was just kind of awkward. And so we wanted something smooth. So we didn't like refilm anything that was important, but I think, you know, we refilmed transitions and stuff like that.
Transitions are so important for this kind of thing too.
Yeah. So I think that was the only thing that it felt more like dipping in and out, if that made sense. And it's because, like, you know, the film crew was all my friends, you know, people who, you know, I had hung out with before and stuff. So, and even the framing narrative of the way the camera, oh, we get to talk about point of view of camera. Great. We can bring this back in. Where the point of view of camera for a lot of APs is just like static audience portal.
And it's almost like in the first like 5 years of film where like all they could think to do was put the camera in the audience and point it at the stage. And like you get like a trip to the moon where like they haven't even thought of like moving the camera towards the moon. They have to move the entire set towards the camera instead. Like, yeah. But yeah, totally.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's people who've done many other things, but it feels like for sure right now we're in a bit of a rut of like
portal
to audience. And the one direction that I gave the cast and everyone who was in the band camera was you are not allowed to interact with or acknowledge the audience who will be watching this at all.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot talk to them. You cannot say hi, look it in the comments, nothing, right? You cannot acknowledge them. That's just not the way that this was going to be framed. Because what I wanted to do was look at other perspectives who could be behind the camera. So for the first part, it's very much the person behind the camera is the friend with the camera. It is the film crew. And that's the reason we have everyone mic up on camera, is to establish that the film crew is a physical presence in it.
Yeah.
They're not a floating camera. They exist in this world.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we're going to get into spoilers here. So if you haven't watched it, I highly do recommend going back and watching it. It's an hour and 25 minutes. We cut it so short. You should watch it. But then, you know, as they transition into the train, the point of view becomes the devil, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why you hear Phoebe's voice a little bit at the beginning, miking us up and giving us intros so that you get that continuity between Phoebe's voice as the camera person and then Phoebe as the devil at the end, kind of mirroring this idea that we are both creator and player in this. And so there's symmetry between the actors and the characters as well as the filming people and the devil. I should note that, like, Phoebe, we did actually split the cinematography up between two folks, and Phoebe was only on the train. But, like, for symmetry, we only hear Phoebe.
Yeah. My experience of watching that opening section is that, like, we see everyone, like, mic up on camera and stuff. We know there's a film crew and so forth. But, like, so quickly, we just, like, melt into this is the friend with the camera who's not talking because they're kind of, like, behind the camera. But then, like, that's me. I'm that friend, right? Like, I'm part of this film crew, because like the shakiness also like makes it feel like POV in a way where like it, you know, if we're watching Dimension 20, it feels like I'm looking through my like peephole into the studio, right, to like see what they're doing, whereas this, it feels like I'm walking along with you. And I think that then like when later on when we get to like, oh, the camera's the devil, I was like, I'm the devil? Wait, no, what's going on here? Like, it's such an energizing moment because it knocks me out of that.
Yeah, maybe there was a bit of thought here about what is an audience? Yeah, and just I really do think a lot about, I think in plays and theater, we know the audience is going to be there because we've invited them in to sit down and we can see them and they can see us. And I think it's just a little bit of a different relationship when you're filming something that is so personal and yet so removed at the same time.
Yeah.
And really thinking about like, what is the audience feeling in each moment?
Yeah. So then we transition into getting onto the train proper. And this feels like a big moment because it is like oh, it's the train. We're like paying off the title of the thing. But also like, obviously like now we're starting to play the game and like now everyone's going to be like fully in character and just mm-hmm. the change in physical location makes all of that super clear. And then, you know, everyone has to get comfortable a little bit with it, but like that also mirrors what it's like. Mm-hmm. And like, it allows me as the viewer to kind of get comfortable a little bit with it. And then you play the game. And I mean, there's a lot of moments in here, like I am entertained by this section, but it also does kind of feel like one thing to me is the next like
yes.
40 minutes of it is just like playing through the main body of the game. And I'm curious to hear you talk about that section a little bit or anything in there you found interesting before people start leaving the train, because that then starts to feel like its own section to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still very much playing with how much to break things up. And I think it was important, at least for this one, that every time we're actually playing the game, we are sitting down at a table.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think I don't really know that much about LARPing, so I really do not want to say anything about LARPing because I know almost nothing about it.
I can say that you LARPed this fucking game, but
great,
like,
okay, cool. Yeah. Like, and so I don't... It felt like we had already broken everything up so much, and this was meant to be played both in the world of the game as written, and then also how, you know, you were supposed to play it, like sitting at a table.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it felt like if we got up and moved around and acted like it was a stage, we weren't actually playing the game.
Totally.
And we would be moving for the sake of moving.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if we were playing that game for real, like, we wouldn't have gotten up. And, you know, I think there's definitely things I want to do in the future, playing with breaking that up more and making it less its own separate thing. But to some extent, it's like, it's a little bit of a respite. We've done so much moving.
Yeah.
And now we're going to sit down and, like, here is you watching us work through this thing we're trying to pay off.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of, like, not breaking it up, you don't really cut much at all in here. Do you cut at all? Like, are there any cuts?
Let's see.
A couple, maybe?
There's maybe like 10 cuts.
Okay.
I'd say there's a couple of cuts when a camera malfunctioned and then when there's a subway door that like stayed open for like several minutes. But no, like I think there's maybe certainly no more than 10 cuts. I would say 5.
You're cutting
yeah.
for tech reasons, not for
yes.
creative reasons,
no.
right?
No creative and reasons.
I find that really interesting because, you know, I'm an editor and my taste in editing is like, get to the goods. Like, let's like polish this. Let's get it down. And like you, it's hard to do that in video, right? That's how you end up mm-hmm. with the YouTube house style of like talking head to the camera, like zippity zappity, like going along. And like that would not fit this well. But also like, I do think like this is the part of the AP that drags the most for me.
Oh, for
and
sure.
And I don't know like how I would fix that because I
yeah,
also
yeah.
think
see,
like what you're
see,
saying
it's, hard.
Like, it's important like it does add something to like not cut very much and to just hold there but yeah
no, I
mean
what you're getting
it feels to use like theater terminology it feels like I'm watching a preview because you haven't done this before you're making it up as you go like this I don't really like watching improv comedy because it's like yeah I think once you run this a few more times you'll like get it in pretty good shape and I'm excited to watch it then right but like this feels a little bit like that to me.
Yeah, I mean, half of it was I challenge anyone to find natural cut points on a moving train.
100%.
So
yeah.
Half of it was just, how would you do that and it not look bad?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm sure there are some ways of doing it. And the other part of it was we had kind of established this perspective. And every time we tried jump cutting in the middle of things, it just felt like we were cutting people off as opposed to making them sound faster, if that makes sense. And, you know, it's like the next AP that we filmed is going to have so many cuts. It's going to be practically exactly in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the answer is it just didn't fit the language of the film. And to me, that's why it's even more important to sell people on why the thing that they are watching is an act of creation, not a final movie.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, and well, and this to me really goes back to that, like, if it were any better, it'd be worse feeling of, like, I do think, like, this is what it has to be. Like, I don't think you can I don't think you can do something that is better than this, but it is also interesting to me to sort of like note the ways that this part becomes lumpy for me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like you're totally right. They're just, I don't know. And like, please, if anyone has any ideas, let me know. I'd love to make things better, but like that's the whole point of putting stuff out sometimes. Well, but yeah.
In some ways, this is the other thing that makes the first act feel so magical to me, is because you figured out a way to make that first introduction to the characters and the players so compelling that like once the like meat of play, massive air quotes, is on camera, I'm invested in it, even though it's a little weak, because I'm so invested from the beginning. And like most AP never gets me invested. So when they're doing this thing on camera, it's like, yeah, that's like all it makes me want to do is like be a part of it, like to go out and play my own games, because my games don't sound any better than this at home. Like this, you've captured the act of playing the game really well. Like, and I love doing it, but I love doing it, not watching it. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
No, that was the goal. I mean, I think,
great.
I mean, I think we've touched on this already, of just some parts of actual play are less compelling and you've got to scaffold people through them.
Yeah. So then we get to the part of the game where people start getting voted off the island, like they start losing their dice and leaving the train. And that becomes really compelling, both because it's sort of, you found your flow, and also like, oh, people are like, this, it's really happening. We're not just doing like the memories now. Like people are like going to hell now.
No, no, and we're on a train.
We're on a train straight to hell, baby. And like, it's also visually, we start to get to mix it up, right? Because when someone leaves the train, that does give the camera a reason to get up and like look out onto the platform and like watch that person go and think about what's happening there. And you get to do a bunch of those like in a row that work really well.
They were just, was there a question there, or just am I just compounding about how cool they are?
It's fucking cool. Like we're pretty deep into this. I've run into this like a movie podcast, right? Where it's like, and then this is the next thing that happens in the movie. And when we get to something, I'll talk about it. I don't know. So people start getting off the train, and then we're finally left with just the Hound, I believe is the last character.
Yeah.
And we,
Hopper.
We get to do the reveal of the camera is the devil.
Yeah.
And this is another interesting moment to me, because I feel like it's the only moment where you changed the rules of the game substantially. Because in the game, all the other players who've been voted off the island, like they come back as like a three-headed devil. And it is this very, like, you have to face your friends in their worst form and like try to justify them to them why you should not die, basically. And like that is, I think, a great decision in the play of the game. And you're giving that up, which is on the one hand too bad, because I think it would be really cool to see here, but you get to replace it with this like incredible technical reveal that also like really energizes those last moments of it. So I'm curious to hear you talk about that choice.
Yeah, part of it logistical. Part of it was that we really didn't want to have anyone on the train car who was supposed to have gotten off the train car that we'd have to worry about filming around.
Yeah.
And then it made specifically the shots of people getting off the train almost impossible to film.
Yep.
Because you want to be able to linger on them. And if they are running to get to another door, or if you cut, it loses all the impact. So we had to leave people on the station, right? That was very important. So once we decide you have to do that, getting people back on the train means, A, we have to switch train cars, which visually, switch train cars because we get off on the next train and we wait till they come back. Visually, we were prepared to switch train cars if we had to, for safety reasons. Like, that was something that I was very, very firm and insistent we didn't have any restrictions, that if anything made anyone uncomfortable, like, we were completely free to hard cut to new train car. Mm-hmm. And we would just never explain what happened.
Yeah.
And that was fine. That was a visual language I was interested in and would be interesting and add to something. But if we didn't have to do it, and if it felt motivated by something other than obviously some unknowable event, if it felt motivated because we had gotten off to get the three people back on the train car, it feels like it loses a little magic there.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
And I think this AP specifically, you know, we've talked a lot about the technical and production intent of it. Wherever we could make a choice to push production and push a technological element, we were probably going to make that choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just the goal of this AP. We really tried to figure out if there was a way of making it work, but it was just so fun to have the double reveal.
Yeah.
And that was something, and that to me, that was something that only we could have done.
100%.
You know what I mean? It's like, there's going to be someone else who does an incredible three-headed devil and have done incredible three-headed devils. And that's going to be the thing that they get to bring as well to this. Like, only we could do this as we're setting it up and make it really feel great. So, like, let's do the thing that only we can do right now.
I think that's a great point. That, like, I think it is often worth doing the thing you can only do in this piece of art because it's going to feel special. And because whatever cool idea you could have done instead, like, you can save for another day and another piece. Yeah. Great. So then the hound loses to the devil, obviously. You can't beat the devil.
He could have.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Actually, did you have a plan there?
Yeah, devil was just going to get off with the camera.
Yeah.
And instead of filming the empty seats, film the empty platform, And we had safety buddies on all of the trains so that no player was ever going to be left alone. So that there would be people on that train with that player. But it was just a great, like, scene. It would have been a great scene where the hound, whoever's left, gets to kick the camera off. Like, the player gets to kick the camera off of the AP, which is really fun.
That would have been beautiful. But that's not what happens. We kick off the hounds. The camera stays on the subway car and continues to power forwards while this incredible song plays
over
credits.
Isn't it great?
It's so good.
So good.
Talk to me about this song. Talk to me about the song.
Honestly, I work with so many incredible fucking talented people. Just, they're so great. So Rowan McStay actually wrote this, and they are the hound. So...
Are they performing it too?
Yeah, they're one of their friends, Amani, actually did the guitar for it.
Sure.
So they're singing and writing. Yeah, so it's one of those. The great thing about doing fun projects is that you get to make your friends do fun things on the fun projects. And Rowan has written so many incredible songs, and they have not yet put them out into the world. And so I do like to joke that I made this entire thing to force them to release a song to the world. So I have at least one thing that I can show people. But it was always, like, a secret hope of mine that they would write something for this.
Yeah.
But they actually, like, suggested it. And they're like, oh, would you want me to? And I'm like, are you kidding? Of course. Your stuff is great.
And when was that happening? Like, was the song, did you have that in pre-pro? Was it after the thing had happened?
Yeah. We shot and filmed and released this in 2 weeks.
Oh, my God. How long was, like, pre-production? Does that include...
Pre-production, are you kidding?
Yeah.
No, pre-production was months.
Well, so that's what I'm asking is like in the months of
pre-production. Well, no, the song was written the song was written after the thing was finished.
Got it. Yeah.
So they also wrote that in like 2 weeks.
In that 2 weeks and recorded it. Yeah. Incredible.
Actually incredible.
It's perfect for the moment because it rides the line between like sad and like melancholy and like that kind of like little bit of devastation at the end of the like deaths of these characters, but the deaths are like metaphor for the like dissolution of this band of this friendship, right? And I think it's more about capturing that feeling than about like someone's going to hell. It's about the like, wow, doesn't it suck when you like you have this a big falling out like this is what I get from it. And then we get to watch as everyone reunites, like the whole crew, we get to see like reuniting on a platform. And then you all go to a diner together and we like go into the diner and see everyone like hanging out at night. And in a perfect world, the sun would be rising, but it's not, it's still late night. And like,
it rose like an hour after that.
Yeah.
It almost was there, but.
In some ways, I like it at night and I'll get into that in a second. But I want to hear you talk about that like ending sequence too. Like I've been framing this whole series on actual play around like normally the show is like we pick one mechanic and break it down as deep as we can, right? And I've been framing this series around let's pick one moment from an actual play and break that moment down as deep as we can. And we've done a lot of moments in this. And in my mind, that is because like the moment I wanted to pick from this is getting to the diner at the end. Like that moment blows me away. And I think you need the buildup and the context of everything else to get to it. So I just want to hear you talk about like that ending and what it means to you and what your intentions were for it.
The moment at the diner was, if not the first visual, I think the second visual after I was like, this happens on a train.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, that, so you absolutely picked it out. Like that was the thing that I had, and I knew we had to get to. So everything else, which train we picked, everything was, how do we get to that moment? I think in part, it serves the same function as getting up from the table. I think if I'm trying to capture something that is this process of creation beginning to end, mm-hmm. ending it on the story is not the end of the creation process.
Yeah, yeah.
And so grabbing that, I think there's also this just, I've also spent a lot of time building up, as we said, like this friendship layer. Mm-hmm. And if we end on everyone is dead and in hell, we have not resolved that. We have not finished that story. Yeah. Also, again, if I'm trying to get everyone to feel this thing that you feel when you're together and it's late at night and you're working on this thing and you've made something fucking incredible, like, you have to see us. You have to see.
We got to see a cast party. Yeah.
You got to see everyone. And like, it was really important to me that it wasn't just the players. It was the safety crew, the swings, everyone behind the scenes. Like that, there was a whole creation process and every single person had the same amount of fun doing it. You know, it wasn't just the people you're seeing on screen. It, like, the creation process is everyone who was making that thing happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it works. I think it's beautiful. I mean, like, I've been saving this the whole episode, but like, to me, what Last Train to Brooklyn is about is being 22 and doing your best. It's being in a group of friends and like, simultaneously, it is about like the like elation of that prepping to go out and then like enjoying each other's company and like getting pizza late at night and getting gelato and like coming home from like whatever fucking thing we were doing on the town and staying up until 3 a.m. at the diner and all of that. And it's also about the like gossip and knives that you're stabbing into each other's backs because you haven't grown up enough. Like you're still mm-hmm. like just mean to each other and like all of that, like that feeling. And then for me, the visual language of the film, like that nostalgia element of it that we were talking about before, and that camera in particular, which is so of my childhood, like hits that feeling of like, it's not that this is about being 22, it's about remembering being 22. It's about remembering and like capturing that feeling of like, remember what it was like, the pain and the like beauty and the love of like all that community that you had like back when I in 2014 like lived in a house with my boys and we played Magic and we went out to the club and all of that. And like that timelessness, that nostalgia, like I think adds to that layer. Like I think the themes of the game combine with the friendship layer you have built. Like neither one of those layers by itself is like actually capturing the truth of this experience. It's like the putting them in conflict with each other, in like tension with each other, that like makes it pop and gives it like an emotional depth that like makes me feel like, yeah, that's exactly what it was like. And then the song at the end, the melancholiness of it is underlying that nostalgia, right? Of like, I don't have that anymore. Like, that's gone. Like, the thing that I lose as an audience member in the moment when the Hound gets off the train is like, I've grown up, you know? Like, that I've moved away from New York. Like, I remember what it was like to go to the diner, to go to the cast party, to flirt with my friends back in high school after we, like, did the theater show or whatever. But, like, I'm 35 now, and I'm married. I'm like, I'm really happy. And like, I don't know. Like, I feel like you've captured all of that so well. And that like in all of that, the like friendship layer of this is the A story, right? Like in like the B story is all that part with the lumps in it, right? Like it's actually playing the game. And like you did great work with that, but it's all in service of capturing what it feels like to be the community of people making the thing. And you know, I had spent all this time before I watched this making these after images and trying to think, like, how do you capture the feeling of being at the table and being a part of that creative process? Like, that to me is the magic of role-playing games more than, like, whatever fucking story we're telling. Like, yeah, great. Like, I like Worlds Beyond Number. Sure. I've had emotional moments, like, listening to the, like, narrative fiction that people are improvising using actual play, but like the beauty of role-playing games, the thing I want to capture on camera that I think actual play is I want it to do is this, is like capture that feeling of friendship and creation and collaboration. Great job.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. No, I'm just, yeah, it's exactly what I wanted people to feel when they watched it, just to understand the thing we're trying to do. And it's great to hear that I've at least made you feel that.
Yeah, I just think it's incredible. I mean, there's no question for you there, but I do like to end with, like, what do you want to end on? Like, do you want to talk about 10 candles and what's next for you? Do you want to, like, emphasize a call to action for other creators? Maybe both? Like, what do you want to go out on here?
Okay, what do I want to go out on? I feel like we could still keep talking about this. That's always the way, isn't it?
100%, but, like, wow, are we half an hour longer than I would like to
yes, yeah, you
I
mean, only
that's the thing. Eventually you grow up and, like, time is ephemeral. Yeah. And like,
no, I mean, there's been times where I'm like, oh, I'm so sad we didn't get that shot. And it's like, no. We didn't get that shot, and that means we do not have to argue about whether we cut it or edit it.
Yeah.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
So broadly speaking, yeah, you kind of nailed it. I think very much like I made this, you know, as you said, I'm 28, like in between my early 20s and then also knowing what's to come. And so it feels like, you know, a little bit mourning what is past and then also wanting to leave myself something to remember as I go forward into the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of mentioned this earlier too, but another thing that I think you couldn't make this at any other age, because like for me at least 28, 26 maybe was like when I was like, oh, I'm good at stuff now. Like
so
you're
like
good enough at
it's
stuff
so nice.
To make something like this, right? Like if you're 22 and you're trying to make this, you're going to fuck it up. And like, but you're also still close enough to that like early 20s feeling to be able to capture it really well. And it's great. And rare.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be the main thing I'd want anyone else to take away from this is like, this works because I'm bringing and my team is bringing like what is special about us and what is special about what we want to say right now in the moment. And I think for actual play, which is such an entwined process with creator and creation, the more that you lean into who you are and what you specifically and no one else can bring to what you're making, the better your stuff is going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, even the stuff we have coming out, I'm like, is this, it does feel like Last Train to Brooklyn was a hell of a first swing. And so now I'm like, okay, what else have I got in the chamber? And the answer is a lot of stuff. It's going to be great.
Love to hear it. Lenny, thanks so much for coming on Dice Exploder and letting me just like gush at you about your thing.
Oh,
and also
no,
telling
anytime,
me so much
anytime.
Behind the scenes about it. Like, really?
Yeah, no, anytime.
And I also like, I really just want to emphasize the call to action to everyone else. Make stuff like this. It's so cool.
Do it.
It's so great. Like, you can do it.
It's so much fun. Yeah, absolutely do it.
Thanks again to Lenny for being here. You can watch Last Train to Brooklyn on YouTube, where you can also check out Twice Rolled Tales' new actual play of 10 Candles. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord. And you can find my games at sdunwall.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next time.